And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and my guest today is Megan Miranda, who has enjoyed a lot of success in writing novels for young adults, like Hysteria, Fracture, and The Safest Lies. Today we'll be talking about her first novel for the adult market, All the Missing Girls, about a woman returning to her small North Carolina hometown to face a new mystery and some old lies. Megan, Nicolette Farrell is heading home to Cooley Ridge in the Smoky Mountains of North Carolina. How long has it been she's lived there?
10 years since she's lived there. She's moved to Philadelphia, where she has made a new life for herself. She's engaged to a lawyer from Philadelphia, and she is a counselor at a school up there. And she's coming home to care for her ailing father.
And she really doesn't have a great desire to go back to North Carolina, does she?
She does not. She is very happy to leave it behind. She has left most of the work for caring for her older father to her older brother in the meantime.
And this really doesn't paint the picture of small town bucolic life. It's a different type of small town, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think there are two sides to that as well. There is the side of, you know, everybody kind of knows everything about each other, and in a way it feels inescapable, and I think that's why she's wanted to leave. But there's also this side of people who know you so well that they will help you as well and rally around you when you need it.
As you said, very two-sided.
Yeah, yes.
Now, where would Cooley Ridge be in North Carolina if it really existed?
It is made up. It would be kind of west of the Waynesboro area, kind of along the Smoky Mountains there.
Now, her brother has called her to come home and help with her father. They moved him into a home the last year. What is he needing the help with Nick, as she's known, to do?
Yeah, so the plan was they've moved him into this long-term care facility, but they've discovered that he doesn't really have much money, so the brother needs Nick's help because he thinks they need to sell the house, and the father does not want to sell the house. So he needs Nick to help convince the father to sell the house or to take guardianship of the father and do this themselves. And then Nick receives a letter from her father talking about the fact that he saw this girl. And this reminds her of a mystery that happened 10 years earlier. She thinks it can only be in reference to her best friend who has disappeared without a trace 10 years earlier. And so she's also going back home to talk to her father and figure out what he meant and what he's talking about.
Because in his state of dementia, he gets a little agitated when he talks on the phone.
He does. And so he has a hard time placing faces at this stage in his dementia. So she thinks she needs to see him face to face and have this conversation.
Now, they've picked this particular facility for him because the food's great. How did you come up with that idea?
You know, I think it was something that Nick was trying to say to make herself feel better of, you know, she has kind of checked out of her life in that way. And so her brother said, well, you know, the food is at least fantastic. And, you know, it kind of alleviates a little bit of her guilt. But it's really, I mean, it's still all really deep in her.
To be honest, she really shouldn't have too much guilt about leaving there because her father was very much an absent parent.
Yeah.
He was not really involved in her life when she was young.
Yeah, her mother died when she was a teenager and her father checked out at that point. So I think it's kind of goes hand in hand with her feelings towards home in general, where there's, you know, a feeling of not wanting to have that relationship, and yet it's what she has left.
So, as you mentioned, she's just become engaged to Everett up in Philadelphia, comes from a big lawyering family who have a lot of money.
Yeah.
It's a very different world for her. Could you tell about their meet-cute?
Yeah. Yeah. So the last time she had been home when she moved her father is actually the story of how they met. She had driven home back from Cooley Ridge, North Carolina to Philadelphia, and she had gotten a flat tire on the way, had had to change it in the rain, and she was not in the best mood when she got home to her apartment. And when she gets home, she runs into her neighbor, who she's lived there for a few years now and still doesn't really know him. And he invites her over for a drink, and he's with a man beside him who is Everett. And that's how she meets Everett.
And this is about the last delightful thing that happens in the book, because it turns dark from there.
It does. Yes. Yes, it does when she goes back home.
And so her brother, Daniel, Dan, very much kind of has a guilt trip that he lays on her a lot, and he's just not having any of her waffle at all.
Yeah, so he's been the one. He's left behind. He has married somebody in that area. They're expecting a baby, and so all of the work has kind of fallen on him with the father. But he also is the one who took over at home when her father checked out 10 years earlier. So he had dropped out of school to care for their mother who was sick and has kind of been the only authority figure in her life.
We go to a flashback at a fair the night that Corinne Prescott disappears. Can you just kind of walk us through that evening at the fair?
Yes. So this is kind of the moment that everyone in the story keeps going back to. It's where it's the last time they saw Corinne Prescott. And so everyone has a different memory of their last moments with Corinne Prescott.
A little bit of a Rashomon thing going on.
Yeah, yeah. So Nick, this scene that she flashes back to, she was on the top of a Ferris wheel with Corinne and their other best friend, Bailey. She saw her boyfriend, Tyler, down below. And she rides the outside of the Ferris wheel on a dare.
And she gets out of the gondola.
She does. She climbs over. She rides it on the way down. Everyone is kind of watching. And when she gets to the bottom, she runs because she knows she's going to get kicked out anyway at this point. And she doesn't know that her brother had been watching. And her brother catches up with her. And in a moment of just emotion, hits her. And that's this moment that they kind of, their relationship kind of falls apart as well.
You almost died. Let me hurt you.
Yes, yes, yes.
I mean, it would be akin to a small child getting spanked if they ran out in the street.
Yes.
But, I mean, he punches her in the face.
He does. It's pretty intense, yes.
And from that night, Corinne goes missing.
Right.
And this is something that Nick has tried to just put out of mind.
Yes.
For 10 years since, so much so that she hasn't even told her fiancé Everett about it.
Right. He actually had never even heard the name Corinne when he comes, yeah.
And so at that point, he gets the feeling that there's a lot of her life that she hasn't shared with him.
Yeah. So I think, you know, when she was up in Philadelphia, she kind of picked and chose what she wanted to share. And he didn't know all this history about her. And she was able to kind of craft her persona of who she wanted to become. And now that she's dealing with her father and her brother and all these memories and this case that Everett just didn't know about, he's realizing there's this whole other side to this person that I've agreed to marry and spend the rest of my life with.
So now that you're 5 or 6 books into your writing career, you've probably worked most of your autobiography out in some way or another. Tell me that none of your life is in this.
Oh, no. No, no, no. None of my life is in this. Yes. That's always a question that you know, people have, and I know it's purely fictional. Yes. Although there is one of the first scenes that came to me when I was writing this book was Nick driving home to Coulee Ridge, and as she's driving, the scenery is changing around her, and she kind of remembers the person she had been as she's going, and it feels like a character shift. And I kind of did the opposite, where I grew up in New Jersey and I moved to North Carolina over a decade ago, and it's a drive that I do often because I have a lot of family up in New Jersey still. And so there's something about that drive where you can feel the scenery changing, and you can almost feel like the person you were in the past, you know, waiting for you at the other spot.
But since you live in the Charlotte area,
yeah,
one of a huge metropolitan area, mm-hmm, how did you get the sense to write that small town milieu?
So I had actually gone on a trip with my husband for our anniversary. We went out to that area. He had liked to go hiking, and I had in my mind that I was going to write a story. And it wasn't this story, but I sat there, and there was just something about that area and sitting in the mountains where you just felt you had to write it. It really kind of spoke to me, and I just had this idea to set it there. I'm really interested in small towns in that way because of how everyone knows everyone so well and everything is interconnected, and you know people from generations gone back at times. I think there's something really fascinating about that you can do with the relationships.
And it seems that's something that her father had a problem with too, since he was brought back to the area by his wife.
Yeah, her father is not from that area. Her mother was, and her mother left and went to school and then got married. And when they were thinking about having a family is when they came back home. And I think that, you know, sometimes is a feeling that I got when I was having a family, this, oh, maybe I should, you know, go back to the place I grew up because it's where I'm from and all my family's there. And so now her mother's gone and it's just the father, and he's a little bit out of place there.
And so when she gets back to the family home, it's been closed up for a year. The air conditioning's not working. It's the most humid time of the year. You can just feel the oppression weighing her down.
Yeah, yeah. So her first feeling when she gets home is not one of positivity. And I think that just kind of goes with her whole gut instinct of, oh, what am I doing here? And it's kind of suffocating down on her.
Yeah, there's just no sense of home.
Right.
The Germans have this phrase, a word called Heimat. And it's a feeling of your home region. And it's this, it's way bigger than we Americans identify with our home regions. Mm. And she has the anti-Heimat feeling.
She does. She does not want to come home. She left pretty much as soon as she could after graduation and after Corinne disappeared. She went to a school in North Carolina, but farther away. And then she slowly and steadily moved farther and farther away. And then she planted her feet in Philadelphia and thought that she would never leave there.
And as it goes along, you see her personality shift between the chapters of going from Philadelphia down to North Carolina. And this meanness starts to come out in the way, because she's our narrator's first person. And you can just see she has very little charity for the people she looks at. And then she says, everyone in this town is a liar.
Yes, yes. So everything is colored by this one experience she had there. And they went through this whole investigation 10 years earlier. And 10 years earlier, this investigation, she says, broke them all open because it's made them spill their secrets. And they all know things about each other that she says were not coming out in that case. So she believes pretty firmly that everyone is a liar in this town.
The homestead on some property out in the country, and it borders some woods. And her brother Dan used to say over the years, there's a monster out there. What was that monster up to out in the woods?
I was really interested in these legends. I had actually read a book of legends that was very unique to certain regions in North Carolina. And I think there's something really fascinating about a place where, so the monster in these woods in Cooley Ridge makes you do things, Daniel tells them. So it's not something that you can see, but something that you can feel, and it makes you do things. And so it's this legend of that there's always something that might be out there that takes people over, that makes them do these dark, dark things.
There are other people who border these woods too, and this Annalise Carter is actually dating her old boyfriend, Tyler.
Yes, yes. So Annalise Carter was 5 years younger than them. So when Corinne disappeared, she was only about 13. And when Nick comes home, Annalise is now dating Tyler. And so it just makes, you know, all these relationships even more complex, and still the feeling of you can't really escape. You know, there's the same people there all the time.
And Annalise was a bit of an odd bird growing up, because when Nick and Dan's mother passed away, her mother would send over food to help them get through the time, and she would just give it to it without saying a word and stayed silent.
Yeah, and so Nick had this specific view of who Annalise was, that she was really quiet and timid. She was really into art and photography and was more the type of person who would be behind the camera, is how she describes her. But she was also somebody who was their alibi the night Corinne went missing. So she's very tied into what happened 10 years earlier. And she's not really sure what to make of her 10 years later, because she never really paid much attention to her. She was, you know, still a child when Nick left home.
And the fact that she's dating Tyler when Nick gets back, it's kind of a surprise, because she's kind of had this hot and cold thing with Tyler over the years.
Yeah. So when Nick leaves home, she is no longer with Tyler, but every time she comes home, she kind of falls into a relationship with him again, even if it's just for a week during spring break or over summer break. They have this connection that she never completely cuts ties with him. But this time she comes back and she's engaged, and now he's dating her neighbor, Annalise.
And Tyler seems to be, on the whole, a pretty good guy. He works with his dad doing contracting and construction.
I think he's a very good guy. He was somebody who had a different reputation when he was younger. Her brother had kind of warned her away from him because he was older than she was. But they were together for over a year when they were children. And he has always been willing to come to her help. So he is helping them turn over the house and get it ready to sell as well.
And it's kind of funny that Dan would warn her, because she, Corinne, and Bailey had a reputation of being kind of the wild children of their class.
They sure did. And I think the brother felt that Nick was pulled in by Corinne as well. Corinne probably had the strongest reputation as being this wild child. And Nick was her best friend and kind of got drawn into that as well.
And of course, back at the time of Corinne's disappearance, the eye is going to be cast on her boyfriend, because so much of our violence against women in society is from their romantic partners. So Jackson is the focus of the investigation.
Yeah, so Jackson was Corinne's boyfriend 10 years earlier, and the case had really affected him because he was cast under suspicion as he was the boyfriend, and there were a lot of conflicting reports over whether they were fighting or broken up or getting back together. And he has still remained in Coulee Ridge 10 years later as well, and is still very tied to this case and still viewed as a person associated.
Now, it's at this point we fast forward 2 weeks, and it's more than just a fast forward. You've introduced reverse chronology into this. So we're going to go forward 2 weeks, 15 days, and then work our way back to when she comes into town. Why did you try this? It seems like such a daunting task.
Yes, it was.
Was that the genesis of the idea for the book, or?
It was. It worked hand in hand. I did have this idea that I wanted to tell a story where the reader is following a mystery along with the narrator, but that at the end, they were also going to kind of experience that moment of what happened. It's not just the narrator picking up clues and then putting it together, but maybe showing what happened. And I really had in my mind, I would like to tell a story backwards and see how that would work. But I had the idea for the backstory of 10 years earlier for all the missing girls. And so that's what I kind of started with working. But the scene that first came to my mind when I sat down to write was the scene of Nick driving home 10 years later and kind of remembering all these moments from the investigation with her best friend. And so I knew I was going to be having two different storylines going on. And that's when I decided to do the present 15 days in reverse.
15 days in the future, Annalise Carter has gone missing.
She has, yes. So she's been missing for about 2 weeks, and there's been a search going on for Annalise.
And it seems that the search doesn't have quite the same intensity as the Corinne Prescott search had 10 years earlier.
So Annalise had left home for college, and she's just come back somewhat recently. Because of that, because she doesn't have as tight-knit group of friends as maybe Corinne did, or she wasn't as central, they definitely do look for her, but it's not quite with the same intensity.
Do you think it's because she's actually an adult? Over 21.
I think so. I think there's something about that 18 that she's still a child who's gone missing, and now she's over 21 and is seen as an adult.
Also, maybe just that trauma of the earlier one kind of has deadened everyone's feelings.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the characters hold a grudge about what happened 10 years earlier, that they felt it really broke open a lot of their relationships, and there's a lot of distrust, and it's taken them a long time to recover from it.
Setting up this reverse chronology is going to make us ask a lot of questions about why you've done this.
Right.
And even more questions about asking why, as you have quotes from philosophers.
Yes.
Heading up each section. So what about Kierkegaard and Nietzsche were so influential that you had to have epigrams from them?
Yeah, I was really drawn to the Kierkegaard quote, actually for years, because I had heard the first half of this quote a lot, that life has to be understood backwards. And then a lot of times I wouldn't hear the second half of that, that it must be lived forwards. And so I think that really played in well to what I was trying to do, that we were going to understand the mystery backward, but that life has to go on as well.
You've even made Nick's father be a philosopher.
Yes, I did. Because I thought, you know, he was somebody who would quote these ideas and he would try to put things into context for Nick that way. And it never really settled right with her. I think she thought that he was trying to maybe not take things as seriously, because he would just come up with a saying to express things to her. But I think it's also influenced her in a great way. And the Nietzsche quote at the beginning of the book is about how the past clings to you. And so Nick has gone 10 years, she's gone many miles away, many states away, and yet that past is still always with her, no matter how far or fast she runs.
It's almost, those quotes are sort of like the equivalent of a greeting card.
Yeah.
Here, I don't care enough to address the situation with my own feelings.
Right.
Here's the way someone else has written about it.
Right. Yes, you said it much better than I was. That's exactly what I was trying to say, yes.
Now, is there anything about the very essence of storytelling itself that you were trying to explore in the reverse chronology?
I wanted the characters and the plot to kind of tie in thematically. And so I was trying to think about why would a character narrate something a certain way, not just for the plot, but why would a person choose to tell a story in this way? So it was tied to why a narrator would do this. And, you know, she's kind of thematically, she's working her way into the past. And I wanted those threads to kind of tie together.
So Nick does know a lot more about what's going on than she's telling us. And so we see this change in her attitude. Mm-hmm. And so we start to distrust Nick as well.
She has a specific view of the events that happened in the past that are colored by what happened in the past as well. And so she's giving, as the present story is being told, she's giving pieces of the past to the reader. But there are things she doesn't want to go back into. And so she is leaving, she's working her way back to those pieces as you go.
Well, and some things she's just integrated, so there's no reason to bring up something that she's already dealt with in her emotional way. But there's stuff in the recent past that's operational knowledge. There's no need to rehash it as you're moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
The practical writing challenge of this.
Yeah.
How did you construct the book in its first draft, and then how did the editing process work to get everything to match up?
Yeah, there was a lot of trial and error in this process. I wrote it in the order that it's read, for the most part, because I felt like, you know, the story arc of when characters were introduced and all their relationships had to still move in that way that you would read it. I would try things that just would not work. And at the end of the day, I would say, okay, I've discovered another way that just doesn't work. And I would put it aside for a little while. I eventually figured out, you know, what I had to encapsulate in a single day, because it's told day by day. So what threads I could leave and what clues I could plant that then would come up in a previous day. And I wrote it that way until about day 4. And then I had to go and write out day 1, 2, 3 and write it in that way to make sure all the pieces were going to line up. And as far as logistically, I would have these spreadsheets of what the reader knows when, what clues have been planted, what's happened, what we know about the past, and then it was just a constantly evolving draft. I've never written something quite that way before. I would get to day 14 and say, oh, well, that had to happen in day 15, and then I'd go back and change, and then I'd get to day 10 and realize, oh, I really needed to plant something in day 13, and so everything was just fluid.
So what would you say to the reader saying, this isn't just a trick? This is actually a really beneficial way to tell a story.
Yeah, I felt that it was really important for, it was the reason, I wanted there to be a very strong tie between why it's being told this way, that it was more than just the plot. And I think when you read it, it will make sense of why she's telling the story this way and that it goes hand in hand with the theme and the characters. The bulk of the book is in reverse, but there is also kind of a beginning and an end. I thought about ending it just, you know, day 15 to day 1, but I wanted there to be, like, to me, the characters were the most important part. And so I wanted it to be more about the relationships and the characters and what happens before and after as well, other than just this is the story and we're starting day 15 and we're ending day 1.
So when I was thinking about the structure of the book, especially with her relationship with Everett, her fiancé, that the book is almost structured in a way in which you would meet someone, potential romantic partner, and you say, well, okay, what do you do for a living? Where do you work? Where do you live? Stuff like that. And then you kind of work your way back in their life. And of course, you're going to uncover stuff along the way that you didn't know, but those things have made them the person they are today.
Yeah, and I hope that this story kind of works the same way, is that we're meeting Nick as she is, and instead of just, you know, her telling you pieces, you're actually seeing the evolution of how she got to that point and the different characters as well.
Now, you also have another YA book coming out this summer. What is that about?
That is called The Safest Lies, and that was based on an idea about the science of fear and whether it would be possible to inherit fears. So it's kind of the idea of nature versus nurture. And it's about a girl who is the daughter of a famous kidnapping victim. And her mother has not left the house since her escape from these kidnappers for 17 years. And she comes home one day and her mother is just gone. And she realizes that people are coming for her. So it's still a YA thriller.
So you think experiences can alter DNA?
So that was kind of the idea of looking into, like, studying epigenetics and what can be passed on, or whether it is that, you know, we're around someone who has taught us to fear these things.
Now, you have a degree in biology, is it?
Yes.
From MIT?
Yes.
Which is very impressive.
Thank you.
So how often does science come up in your stories?
In my young adult stories, my ideas are usually based on weird science stories or inspired by things I've thought about. They are usually sparked by science. In All the Missing Girls, it doesn't have the science element in it.
So with the structure of All the Missing Girls being so different, did that help you in transitioning and writing away from the YA audience to a more adult audience, that it just changed the way you think about everything completely about writing?
Yeah, I think because it was so different, it was just a completely new experience. I am still drawn to what happens at 17, 18, 19 years old.
And because that is an aspect of the book.
Yeah. So it's viewing those things, but in hindsight now still. So it's her older, but there's still that element of how what happened when we were teens still affect us 10, 15, 20 years later.
So you've written these YA books where terrible things happen to people. You've written this book for adults where terrible things happen to young people and adults. So being a parent, how do you make it through the day?
Oh, yeah. It's funny because my kids are 8 and 10 now, and they're getting curious as to what I'm writing. And I say, well, it's a little scary. And, you know, my son wants to know, well, why do you write that? And I say, well, it's almost like taking charge of it. It's your imagination, so you know that it's not true. But it is, like, especially when you're researching, you're exposed to stories of things that happen. And so I have to kind of turn that off when I step away from the computer.
And are you going to be writing another book for the adult audience?
I am. I'm in the process of editing it right now. It is another kind of psychological thriller in that same vein.
So how can you keep up this work pace?
My kids are old enough now. They're in school from 9 to 3, and those are my writing hours. And so far, my deadlines have not overlapped in that way. And I don't usually keep track of a word count because I'm not much of an outliner. So I have to write my way into the story. But I feel like even if I'm deleting something, I'm making progress on the story. I really love it. Like, it's the thing I really look forward to doing. So I drop my kids at school, and we walk to school, and so on the way home, I'm thinking about what I want to be writing when I'm home. And so when I get to the computer, those ideas are fresh, and I'm able to get the words out.
Do you have time to read anymore?
I do. I read at night, yes.
And so what have you been reading recently?
I've just recently read In a Dark, Dark Wood by Ruth Ware, which is a psychological thriller. It takes place at a bachelorette party where there is a murder, but you don't really know at the start who was killed or what happened. The narrator kind of wakes up in the hospital, and so you're piecing together the different mysteries, and it was really like you couldn't put it down. I had to keep flipping the pages.
Well, Megan, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing your book with us today, and it's really been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Megan Miranda is the author of All the Missing Girls, which is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.